Welcome to the Sam Gash podcast. These are conversations with trailblazers, rule breakers, and those who pave their own lane and venture boldly into the unknown. By entering this uncharted arena, they inevitably stumble, yet they all display an ability to innovate and contribute, even when the odds are not in their favour. We skip over their highlights reel and go into the guts of who they are and what they believe in. I'm your host, Samantha Gash, and I'm an endurance athlete, a former corporate lawyer, and social impact entrepreneur. It is my absolute privilege to create the space for these guests. If you found these conversations to be of value or have any feedback, please subscribe, rate, and review, and I hope you enjoy. Well, welcome back. This is part two of a two-part series with Rich Roll. If you haven't checked out the first one, jump back out and go into episode 31. If you are here, continuing on our journey, welcome back to the space. Well, continuing on the vein of people in your life, probably someone that is interesting in a different level, Bruce Kimball.
Oh, wow. You pulled that one. I didn't see that one coming. That's an interesting one.
I know. I didn't do a very good segue to it.
No. No, it's good. How do I contextualize this? So, as I said earlier, you know, when I was a senior in high school, I went from being this kind of, you know, awkward kid who couldn't make friends to somebody who was like at the top of my class in my school and being recruited by all these colleges for swimming. And I really, I really had like my choice of where I wanted to go. It was an incredible time. And one of the recruiting trips that I went on was to the University of Michigan. My whole family is from Michigan. Everybody in, you know, like my whole extended family, you know, has gone to this university. Of course, the person I was named after, you know, was captain of the swim team at University of Michigan. His picture is like in the natatorium that's called the Matt Mann Natatorium, which was his the name of his coach at that time. So there's this tremendous legacy. So I go and I visit this school. The coach at the time was new. I think he'd only been there a year or two. His name was John Urbanchek. He would go on to have an incredibly legendary career as a swim coach. He became an Olympic coach. And I was there to see the school, and there was a dual meet that afternoon. And then afterwards there was a party at one of the swimmers' houses. And this was really one of my first introductions to alcohol. Like, there was a keg, and like these swimmers who I respected and revered, who had just swam really fast at this meet, were all like, you know, drinking beer out of this keg. And I wanted to connect with these people. I wanted to feel like I was part of, you know, this community. And I'll never forget that a beer was handed to me by this guy, Bruce Kimball. And you know, most people probably don't know because they're younger, but Bruce Kimball was a legendary diver of his era. His father was actually the diving coach at the University of Michigan. I think he was multiple Olympics. I can't recall. At least one. He went to at least one Olympics. And he handed me this beer, and I started getting a buzz on. I was drinking with him, and then he proceeded to pull off like the greatest party trick to this day that I've ever seen, which is he held a cup of beer that was completely full, and from a flat-footed standing position, launched his body into the air and did a perfect backflip and landed, just nailed the landing, just stuck the landing, holding his beer the entire time, and he didn't spill a drop out of it. And I just thought, how did that guy do that? And whatever he has, like, that's what I want, you know. And I was all in from that point forward. And I ended up getting super drunk that night, hanging out with these guys. And, you know, Bruce Kimball, this person who had just done this thing, who had, you know, become like my immediate new idol, would go on to, you know, really destroy his life and his career through drugs and alcohol. He ended up driving drunk, plowing through a crowd of people. I think he killed at least one person and went to prison. He was in another terrible accident that kind of destroyed the construction of his face. And ultimately, like, his whole life fell apart because of his alcoholism. And little did I know that that was kind of a foreshadowing of my version of what was to come in a small part. And, you know, I think back on that guy as well, like, you know, somebody who was so talented and so brilliant at what he did, who was also so powerless over this substance, to such an extent that it not only destroyed his life, but it destroyed the lives of other people as well.
I mean, have you ever spoken to him since that moment, or is it just that one occasion that you had with him?
It was the only experience that I've had with him. Yeah. It would be interesting to reach out to him. I actually don't even know what's going on with him now.
When you heard about the car accident that he had, like, at what stage were you in your intensive relationship with alcohol at that point?
That's a great question. I don't even know. I can't even remember what year that was. So I don't have a specific memory of coming into that information. But I'm sure that, you know, I was at some level of progression in my own relationship with alcohol. And what happens with that is there's a denial mechanism that you know, is at play that prevents you from really connecting in an honest way with kind of the objective reality of your situation and whatever emotions that brings up. Like, everything's just kind of compartmentalized and pushed away.
Yeah, I just had a quick look. It was in 1988 when he had the, when he killed two boys and injured four others, when he kind of drove his car through a crowd of teenagers.
Yeah. So I would have been a junior in college. So yeah. I was still, you know, that was only 3 years after I met him at that point.
Mm. Yeah. How long would you have considered yourself to be an alcoholic?
I think that I had an unhealthy relationship with alcohol from the very first drink. You know, it's not like suddenly you're, you know, living in the gutter. It doesn't work that way. But I knew on an unconscious level, like, my relationship was different from that of my peers. Like, my peers could go and they, you know, when you're in college and you binge drink and you party and all that kind of stuff that goes on. But I had, for me, it was just a little bit darker. Like, I was the guy who really didn't want the party to end, who was like the last person to leave and looking for the half, you know, filled empties around the room and drinking them when no one was looking. Like, really kind of unhealthy behaviors at a very early stage in all of this. And then it just kind of increases very, very gradually. And you're able to kind of write off whatever chaos or drama is caused by these incidents early on as just stuff that happens and you're young and you can laugh about it. But they get, you know, more grave as you progress, and it gets lonelier and darker and more consequential. So, you know, I began my drinking career around 17, 18. It ended when I was 31. I would say I was an alcoholic the entire time. I'm still an alcoholic. I'm just not drinking right now or anymore, or at least for today. But, you know, in terms of other people being aware of me being an alcoholic, it wasn't until the later stages. And it was only, you know, in those later stages that I was able to kind of even consciously grapple with the idea that that might be the case.
Do you think when you were younger and you were drinking, it wasn't so much picked up by other people, because when you're young, just kids just naturally drink, and so you can just put it off as a young kid having a few extra drinks?
Of course. Yeah. And I wasn't getting into huge trouble, and I was functional. I'd show up for swim practice, and I would still, you know, get decent grades. And there was nothing you could point to and say, this kid's life is going off the rails. And that's part of, there's part of that that's also alcoholic. Like, that's how you protect your ability to continue to drink, by continuing to excel or at least show up for the other areas in your life. But those become less important. And what becomes paramount is, when am I drinking next? Where is this happening? Who's coming with me? How am I, you know, setting in motion everything that needs to happen for me to be able to, like, get super drunk tonight? And that really begins to monopolize your thinking.
As that was starting to monopolize your thinking, were other interests that you previously had, do they start to become muted or less important? Like, how does your relationship relationship with the other things in your life become?
Yeah, you become, or I should say I became, less interested in the aspirational aspects of what I was doing. You know, after my freshman year in college, I never really swam fast again. I continued to, you know, be on the swim team until my senior year, and I would show up for workouts, but it was a different relationship with the sport. Like, it just wasn't as important as it used to be. And I never really put thought into anything long term. Like, my field of view was really very limited to, you know, where's my next good time? And that's all I really cared about. So grades, career, all of that became secondary and just not that interesting or important. And it's very subtle at first, because I'm going to classes and I'm doing all the things that all my friends are doing. It's more of a like your internal relationship to those things and how engaged you are in your own life. That becomes denigrated and eroded. And again, it's something that, you know, rust doesn't show up on steel overnight. Like, it's very gradual. It takes time. And it's a similar thing where it's happening. And it's not until, you know, some crazy event happens that you're able to shake yourself out of your, you know, living daydream to realize, you know, what it is exactly that you're doing, how you're behaving.
Do you mind sharing how this impacted your relationship with other people? I mean, it sounds like you were living this dual life, you know, on the exterior, this successful lawyer, but the reality is addiction was playing a huge part of your life. How would you describe that you were showing up to those close to you?
I wasn't showing up very well for the people in my life. I mean, there is it's a little bit more complicated in that alcohol works until it stops working. And it actually did me a service as a young person. It taught me how to be a social creature. Like, I was somebody who was so terrified of other people and didn't really know how to interact. And alcohol gave me the ability to walk into a crowded room of people and strike up a conversation or crack a joke or look people in the eye and feel like I belonged or that I could own my geography. And, you know, when the drinking gets taken away, like, I still have that, you know, that. So it kind of, in a perverse way, it taught me certain things, certain life skills that served me. But what happens is it turns on you, right? And then it becomes something that you need. It becomes this coping mechanism. It becomes this thing that you can't go out into the world without it. You become dependent on it. And that's where a lot of the kind of secret behavior starts to happen, and the hiding and the lying. And all of this, when I say coping mechanism, it's a shield that is allowing you to mute out whatever challenging emotions you're feeling in your life, right? And that stunts your ability to mature emotionally as a human being. So there's a kind of a saying in recovery that when you get sober, you're the emotional age that you were when you began drinking, because that experience of an alcoholic just basically puts the cap on your ability to, you know, grow emotionally as a human being. So you have to, when you get sober, you have to, like, learn all of these basic things that everyone else has kind of been just, you know, absorbing through the course of living their lives naturally. And they're very difficult to learn, you know, in at that later state. So to answer your question, when you're in this chronic alcoholic state, you're not dealing with your life. And so you're kind of moving forward. Yeah, I went to law school. You know, I could go through the motions in my life, and I felt like I was fulfilling the role that would meet social expectations and the expectations of, like, my parents, who would be happy if I went to law school and got a good job at a law firm. But never once did I stop and do any self-inquiry about what it is that, you know, I actually wanted to do with my life. Like, that just wasn't part of it. Mm-hmm. And when you're drinking all the time, you're just running away from anything difficult, you know, any kind of difficult decision-making. And it's easy to live your life reactively. And the path of least resistance, ironically, was to, like, go to law school, as opposed to figure out like, hey man, like this is not for me. Like I can't be this square peg trying to jam it into a round hole anymore. It's not working. I need to do something else. So I had to live this whole other life that was very inauthentic to myself, unbeknownst to me. It's not like I was consciously aware of it. I just felt like this is what I'm supposed to do. Other people seem to like it. I don't really like it, but suck it up. Like, you know, I know how to suffer. I learned that in swimming, and just, you know, go to your job and just suffer, you know. I just thought that's how everybody approached their life. And I had to have, you know, another, you know, kind of bottom, spiritual bottom, physical bottom, in order for me to kind of snap out of it and you know, and reckon with this kind of wreckage that I was creating. So there's all kinds of, you know, like there's dealing with the alcoholism, but once you stop drinking, then you're this raw nerve of all these emotions that are very confusing. So all of this takes a long time and many, many years and a lot of like deep self-inquiry and work in order to like sort out so that you can figure out who you are and the path it is that you're best suited to pursuing.
I think it's very helpful that you don't glamorize like that hard work, that process of recovery, because for those who are in it, I think whilst that might be a little daunting, it's reality, and it almost prepares people that it's not necessarily going to be smooth sailing. When you hit rock bottom, I mean, firstly, if you could share what that place was, because obviously you had plenty of low moments in between that, but the rock bottom that made you go, I'm going to go into recovery and I'm going to spend 100 days sorting this out at a facility.
Yeah, my life had been going south for quite some time, but then it really escalated during the last year of my drinking. And over the course of that 12 months, I got 2 DUIs in a 2.5 month period, blowing like 0.27 and 0.29, like really high blood alcohol levels. I rear-ended a woman at a stop sign. The second time I got pulled over, going the wrong way down a one-way street, I was looking at jail time. I had my license suspended. I was about to get fired from my law firm job because my boss represented the police department that arrested me and he knew what was going on. This house of cards was falling on top of me. Meanwhile, I had a marriage that went sideways, that ended on the honeymoon in a very kind of public and painful way for me. So painful that I had to drink more just to deal with the confusing emotions of that, until I found myself utterly alone, alienated from my family who had had it with me and couldn't deal with me anymore, on the precipice of getting fired, in a shitty apartment, sleeping on a mattress on the floor, in, you know, just an unfurnished apartment. And no one who would take my call anymore. Like, it was really desperate, dark. There was nothing sexy or romantic or Charles Bukowski about it. It was just sad and pathetic. And I knew that if I didn't do something, that I was going to, that, you know, this is how the rest of my life was going to be, and I was probably going to die. And with the help of an addiction psychiatrist that I was seeing, I was able to get a bed and a rehab and ended up in this treatment center in rural Oregon, heading into it thinking, I'm just going to be here for a couple weeks because I'm Mr. Big Important Lawyer Guy and I got stuff to do. But yeah, I guess I got to do this to sort my hash out, and ended up staying there for 100 days, which is a pretty long time to be in what is ostensibly, you know, a mental institution. You know, I'm this guy who thought I was so smart, who had all this opportunity as a young person, and my best thinking landed me in this place of last resort, this institution for people that are behaving in an insane way in their life. And that reality, when it dawned on me, when the fog lifted, that reality was not lost on me. And I realized that I needed to really figure out what was wrong with me and find a solution to what was ailing me if I wanted to survive, let alone thrive as a human being. And that's a long way of saying that I was blessed with willingness to do the work, to set aside my self-will and idea about, you know, what I thought I should be doing or what would get me sober, and to receive help from other people, which is the really hardest part of the whole thing, to have the humility to set aside your idea of what you think you're supposed to be doing and to let others in. Because the alcoholic doesn't want to let anyone in. They want to isolate. They want to block everyone out. And that kind of tweak, that flick of the switch where I became willing and I would do whatever it took and I made sobriety my number one priority, saved my life and continues to save my life to this day.
I mean, that's certainly the real work of treating addiction, at least for you it was. Mm-hmm. How were, I guess, your family members and your friends receptive to you once you were on this new path? Like, did it take time to repair trust, or was there an openness to it?
It took a long time. It took a long time. And, you know, it was easier with some than with others. My family was relieved. They came up for like the family weekend, you know, at the rehab that you see in movies. And that was not fun. You know, they get to present me with all the times that I screwed them over or did some insane thing and terrified them. It was very, very painful and difficult to basically sit there quietly and let them share, you know, their version of who I was in a structured environment. But again, that's part of the healing process and was required. And it took a long time before my family was, you know, willing to trust me. And I accepted that going into it. At the same time, like I also, you know, I had good friends most of my friends were just scared. They were just scared that something really bad was going to happen to me, and they were relieved that I was getting help. Yeah. But there were a lot of friends that I had to, you know, get rid of, you know, the lower companions, and I needed a new social environment, you know. So thank God, like, the recovery community in Los Angeles is incredible. There's so many interesting young people who are active in sobriety, you know, in the AA community, in the 12-step community in Los Angeles. So I was able to, I really just invested myself in that community and made some incredible friendships that to this day are some of my best friends. So I had to, you know, they say you only have to change one thing and that's everything. And I took that to heart and I really did. I literally changed everything in my life.
And this is going to be personal to you in that it's your experience, but what would be one piece of advice that you could share for people who are going through addiction, recovery, self-doubt, trauma that has stood the test of time for you?
Hmm. There's so many like pithy statements, you know, the little like annoying phrases in AA that are annoying because they're true. But the one I would say that has been very powerful for me, and I think is helpful to people who are out there who are suffering right now, is that shame can't survive the light. And most of the people who have suffered trauma or who are stuck in that cycle of addiction and can't find their way out are living in terror, and they're doing it quietly and privately, just completely overwhelmed with the shame of their personal experience and under the misapprehension that if they were to share how they were actually living or what was actually going on with them with another human being, that they would be ostracized. And I can tell you that nothing is further from the truth, and that the path towards healing and redemption and wholeness starts with raising your hand and asking for help and finding another human being that you trust, that you can share the truth of your experience with. Because short of that, you will remain in that unhealthy place and, you know, to the depths of despair. So when you shine a light on that thing that you're so afraid of, or that behavior that you're so ashamed of, or that thing that happened to you, and you connect with another human being over it in an honest way, that is how you move forward. And It might be the hardest thing that you ever do. But as somebody who's been part of this community for 23 years at this point, I've seen miracles happen with people who can summon that kind of courage, which it does take a tremendous amount of courage. But if you can summon the courage to do that and to openly relate the deepest, darkest thing that you're holding on to, your life can change in ways that you can't even begin to fathom.
And what if you are a loved one that is watching someone go through this and you feel like you've tried, you know, to communicate with them, it's not working, like, what can they do?
That's the hardest thing. That is the hardest thing. And that's something that I don't have an easy answer for. I try to think about the pain that my parents were in when I was out there doing what I was doing and the powerlessness that they had to get me to see the reality of my situation, let alone change my behavior. There is a powerlessness with it. And I think the first thing that somebody in that situation has to understand is that you really are powerless, that willingness is everything. And if the person who is active in their disease isn't willing to make a change or to listen or to heed you, that there is very little that you can do. The most important thing for you to do is to make sure that you're taking care of yourself and that you've erected healthy boundaries around the person who is active in their disease. And with love and compassion, to let them know that you're available to them no matter what in the event that they would like to seek help, but at the same time that you cannot participate in a codependent way in the cycle of addiction or unhealthy behavior that you're bearing witness to. And to detach from that person that you love who is in that cycle is really a heart-wrenching thing to do. But I do think, you know, to bring it back to my own experience, because one of the fundamental things about all of this is, like, I'm not here to give anyone advice. I can only share my own experience. And in my experience, when my parents pulled back and said, we're not going to be involved in this anymore in the way that you're living, that was a pretty profound aspect of what ultimately led me to getting well. Like, the idea that these people who had been in my life and had been a support system forever were no longer going to be a support system helped me to break that that chain of denial and reflect more honestly and objectively on the reality of my predicament. So be gentle on yourself. Let the person know that you're available. And you can try the interventions and you can do all of that. I just know that when the person, and sometimes it works, but the thing is, it's like, these are very specific things. Like, it's hard to give general advice on this. So in the most general terms, you're available to that person when they need help, when they demonstrate willingness. And in the meantime, you have got to take care of yourself and not allow yourself to get pulled into the cyclone of unhealthy behavior that will undoubtedly, you know, bring you down in the mix.
I really appreciate you sharing that, Rich. And I know you've shared it before, but I think this is information that people really need to hear. And it's very brave and bold, and it would have been terrifying for your parents to kind of let go of that, you know, umbilical cord in a sense, because as human beings, we want to fix things. But you can't fix things if the person doesn't want to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And if they don't see it's a problem that they want to change. And I know Julie wasn't in your life at this time. And, you know, after this point of recovery and the continual recovery, you worked in another law firm, you're working incredibly hard, but you met Julie during that time. And, you know, the way I think of Julie is, like, she's so different from you in so many different ways. And you have this really incredible and interesting relationship, but it sounds like she's always been someone that goes, like, you know, you can't force someone to make change, they need to want it, which is kind of the relationship the two of you had with food, because she lived a very different lifestyle than you did, but you lived together in a relationship. And I think it's really helpful for people to understand how you can coexist with someone where there are some pretty fundamental differences, but there can still be a harmonious relationship. Do you think you can share a bit of like your synergies, but your differences in those earlier years?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's almost like a different version of the same thing that we've been discussing, you know, in certain respects. I mean, you know, Julie, my wife, Julie, who I've been with since the year two, we've been together 20 years. In the early years of our relationship, she was somebody who has always been super healthy, you know, eating really clean and like really concerned with, you know, being organic and like taking care of yourself and growing spiritually. Like on her, you know, bedstand were all these, you know, amazing books from all these different types of people. And she was always like a seeker, you know, like how can I be better in various ways? And I was very kind of emotionally dense. Like I was eating, you know, McDonald's and Burger King on the way home from work. And I just wanted to like watch Law and Order at night and like leave me alone. Like I was not on her like growth trajectory. I was like, you know, I'm tired, man. Like, you know, I work hard, like leave me the fuck alone. And, you know, at some point, like we have great affection for ourselves, but it became like almost, you know, not a dysfunction, but there was a disconnect. Like, are we on the same page here? Like, are we like, are we gonna, like, if we're gonna be together, like, are we, Are our trajectories going to diverge at some point because of this? And Julie, you know, she'll say now that she's somebody who was always able to see like the more actualized version of me, like, you know, behind this density. Like she's like, this guy's stuck. He's not happy, but he can't see it for himself. Like I was sober, but I was still pursuing this career that was at odds with me. And I was learning, you know, these kind of emotional and spiritual skills very slowly, but I still had so much to learn. And she was like, this guy could be so much more. He can't see it for himself, but like I see it. Like, so she would say, why don't you read this book? Or like, why don't you like not eat, you know, that and like try this? Not in a nagging way. Like I want to be very clear. She's like, you live your life, dude. But like, you know, I see that you're not happy and you're suffering. Like this might help you. But you know, anybody who's in a relationship knows, like when your partner's like, try this, like, I don't know about you, but like the response that creates a recoiling in me. Like that just makes me want to do it less, you know, like don't tell me what to do. I'm so unlikely to do that now that you've suggested it. At least that's me. And eventually Julie just kind of gave up because this clearly wasn't working anyway. And she had to really, like, she would tell her friends, like, you know, I keep trying to help him. He's not doing it. Her friends would be like, oh, he's, you know, it's like when you do that, like you get the response that, you know, that you want to hear, which is like, you're so right. You're so right. But ultimately, she had to figure out, like, if this guy never changes, do I still want to be with him? Because that's really the main inquiry, right? Like, it can't be all relationships, all kind of love as we understand it, is really a social contract, and it is conditional. It's like, I love you as long as, like, you don't cheat on me or you don't run away with the money. You know, it's like there are conditions on, you know, our relationships in this human form that we're in. But there is a bigger love at play, like the you know, the spiritual love, like the idea that, you know, the sun doesn't discern where it shines, like it shines everywhere. Like, can you love in that way? And she really asked herself, like, can I love this guy, irrespective of whether he wants to, you know, go on this path that I'm on. And she kind of got to a point where she was like, I do, like, I still dig him. Like, I still want to be with him. And because she did that work, she was able to let go of any baggage around any of this. And she really did let it go. And I could feel that. She didn't make an announcement to me like, hey, I'm going to leave you alone now. But I could tell like she wasn't vibing me at all. Like, you need to do this or you need to do that. She's like, do your thing, man. Like, I love you. Like, we're in this relationship. But I think that when that kind of polarity was gone, I could sense that. And it was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, now she doesn't need me to be any different. So I need to figure out what it is that I want. Like, it created this opening. Like, it's hard to describe, but suddenly it wasn't like, oh, should I eat better for her? It was like, I don't feel good in my body. Like, maybe I don't want to keep doing this. But suddenly I was in a position where I had to take responsibility of that for myself, as opposed to waiting for somebody else to do it or to kind of nudge me into doing it. And I think that accelerated this, you know, moment that I came to before I turned 40, where I was like, I'm done, and I am taking responsibility for this, and I am going to change. And I think what gets overlooked in the kind of story that you read about, if you Google me, is like, oh, he was on the staircase and then he just had this epiphany. And it's like, no, you know, like, there, it's way more complicated and nuanced. And like, Julie's kind of energetics around this whole thing played a huge part in not only it happening, but kind of like when and how it happened.
I love that. And it rings true to my personal experiences. Like, Mark's always said to me, like, the more you try and fix me or get me to do a certain thing, the more I hold tension to like my control. Because it has to be like, I might want to do that thing, but if you're trying to take ownership over it, I can just be a passenger.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll probably be a resistant passenger at that.
Right.
I think we do need to let people find their path in their time frames. And as you just said, then the reality is when you get that opening of space and that I love you regardless, this is, you know, who you are, I still love you. I think people do come to it quicker. And it's just really great to hear you explain how that worked in your situation.
Yeah. It's like, okay, you could be who you want to be. Who do you want to be for you? You know, because honestly, until it's for you anyway, any kind of lifestyle change isn't going to stick anyway. If you're doing it for somebody else or to get somebody else off your back or to placate somebody, you're not doing it for yourself. You have to really do it for yourself. And that's something you can't will in another human being. They have to come to it on their own. But the best way to help them come to it on their own is to get out of the way.
You know, your health and fitness journey is starting to evolve. This athlete side of you is re-emerging for the second time. I want to hear about Ultraman. I'd love to hear what it was about that race that called to you, how you got into it, considering it was an invitational race and you didn't really have the pre-requirements to getting into it.
Sure. I mean, first of all, so much of this is timing. Like, it wouldn't be possible now because the endurance community has grown so much since this time. What happened was I'd had this kind of lifestyle epiphany. I changed my diet. I was engaging with myself in a physical way for the first time in a long time. I lost all this weight. I was feeling amazing. And that led me to kind of wanting a challenge. Like, you know, part of that is like, oh, I'm 40 and it's a midlife crisis thing, you know, like, and part of it was I have unfinished business as an athlete because I don't think I ever reached my potential as a swimmer because of my alcoholism. And another part of it was like, this is cool and fun and I need adventure. And on an unconscious level, I think part of it was I need to figure out who I am. And there's something about extended time with an elevated heart rate that is very healing and curative and instructive in trying to answer these difficult questions. And, you know, Samantha, I mean, you're somebody who's has more experience with this than almost anybody I know. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Like, when you have a big problem that you're trying to solve or you're trying to, you know, really more deeply connect with who you are as a human being, like, there's no better vehicle or tool for that than time alone, like on the trail or on the run. And I was in that place and I'd come across this article about this race, Ultraman. I was considering, like, maybe I'll do an Ironman. I didn't really know much about the ultra endurance world. And I saw this article about this race I'd never heard of called Ultraman, which is a double Ironman distance triathlon that over the course of 3 days, you circumnavigate the Big Island. It's a 320-mile race broken into three separate day stages. And in this particular article, it was really focused on David Goggins, who nobody knew at this point. Now he's like, everybody knows who David Goggins is. I promise you, nobody knew who he was at this time. He had just done Badwater and like went right from Badwater. And I think he got second at Badwater, had some amazing result after, you know, and it was his, I think it was his first time, and he was brand new to this world. And then he went straight to Ultraman and never really, you know, hated swimming, never really trained on a bike, and had to like tape his running shoe to his pedal. It was some crazy story. And ultimately he still ended up like second. And this was a guy who hadn't been a runner or a triathlete, but had been like a big football player who'd lost a bunch of weight. And there was just something so inspirational about not just David's story, but also the manner in which this journalist described this race, Ultraman, that made it feel not really like a race, like an Ironman, but more like this spiritual odyssey where this hand-selected group of 35 athletes and their crews have this collective adventure of going around this island over a three-day period, with the goal, the kind of overarching goal, being that everybody is transformed as a result. Yes, it's a race. There are people who want to win. It's a world championship. But that's not the priority. The priority is to basically elevate the spirit as a result of connecting with this island. And I just thought that was the most magical, amazing, extraordinary thing that I'd ever read. I couldn't believe that a human being could actually do this kind of thing. And it was like this switch flicked, and I was like, I'm doing this. Like, it makes no sense. I hadn't done a half Ironman. I had done nothing. And I was like, I'm doing this race, which is insane. Like, there's no rational, logical foundation for me thinking that I had any business even entertaining this, at least for a couple years, you know, if I trained super hard. But I had it in my mind, and I knew on some level that it was crazy. So I thought, but I couldn't sleep. Like, I couldn't get out of my head. So I was like, I gotta like channel this energy in certain directions. So I found the race director. Her name was Jane Bacchus. And I said, I'm just going to call her because she could talk me out of this and just tell me it's never going to happen. And then I can forget about it. But until I do that, like I'm obsessing on this thing. So I called her up and I said, I explained to her who I was and that I'd read this article and I was fascinated with this race and I was really interested. I know that, you know, it's kind of crazy and it was too early to even submit an application, but I just felt compelled to reach out to her and see if there was any possibility that I could do it or whether that was just lunacy. And she said, you know, what have you done? And I said, nothing, you know, I literally had done nothing. And she, if she was in her right mind, she should have said, well, why don't you, you know, call me in a year and, you know, and put together a few races and then we can have a conversation. But instead she said, I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to say yes. Like, why don't you call me in a couple months and let me know where you're at? Like, she didn't commit, but she didn't say no. And that was really all that I needed. It was like, in my mind, she'd already said yes, even though she hadn't. And I was like, this is some kind of weird permission slip, and I'm just going to pretend like I've already been invited to do it and act as if. And that's what I did. And I ended up hiring a coach and set about, you know, putting together a plan to prepare for this crazy thing. And ultimately my coach ended up vouching for me and like writing a letter to Jane and saying, I will make sure that I have him ready. I know he's a risk. And then Chris, my coach, telling me, listen, like, my reputation is on the line. Like, if I tell her you're going to be ready, that means that you cannot flake on me, because one day, you know, maybe I want to do this race, or, you know, I'm going to send other athletes, you know, to do this race. So you cannot let me down. And I took that seriously, and I never missed a workout. I approached it like, you know, my career, and I showed up as prepared as I possibly could, and she let me race, and that was that. And it was amazing. And I think, you know, it speaks to the power of belief, but also like this weird, there was just something inside of me that felt like this is how I'm going to calibrate my compass. And even though it defies logic. Like it just, I knew that it was right. And I knew that it was the path forward for me.
I mean, yeah, it, in many respects, it does defy logic, but you and I have both been witness to people who have tackled things so beyond their past experiences. And it's not just the self-belief. I think that's obviously critical, but it's the fact that they have immense follow through with creating a strategy that's going to set them the path to defy their limited past experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that hard work is what some people, well, I would say the majority of people, omit when they craft goals that are so lofty and beyond themselves. Because I think you need to have both belief and the hard work at play, all the smart work. And obviously when you spoke to Jane, I mean, if I called up Jane right now, I feel like she would have a different response to that question. I think she would say something about the essence of what you shared and the feeling in which you gave her, because even though, you know, Ultraman was more niche then, there was less people wanting to do it, she's not going to put her race's reputation on the line by someone who's a complete rookie without some belief in her gut that you at least could get through it unharmed.
I think that's right. And I think the other aspect of that is that, you know, although this particular race is a world championship, the discretion, the invitations fall on the shoulder of the race director. And I think Jane,
yeah,
and now Cheryl, who runs it because Jane's retired, their barometer isn't like, we just want the fastest, best athletes. Their compass is calibrated by finding the right people. Like, who are the people that can embody the ethos of what this event is really about best? And who are the people who could become, you know, who need this transformation or could be the best benefactors of what this, you know, potential opportunity has to offer them? I think that's a big part of the calculus. And I would venture to say that Jane probably would say, like, this guy needed it. I could tell there was something genuine in his voice. And this is, you know, this is somebody who, you know, kind of fits the mold of what we're looking for in terms of the kind of people that are open to, you know, the experience that we're trying to convey. You know, it's not just because you get like the super hardcore type A athlete in there who's just like in it to win it and doesn't care about anyone else. That's not really, you know, the Ohana spirit of Ultraman that they're trying to, you know, evoke. So I think you're correct in that.
And you did it the first time and then you did it the following year. And obviously not everything went to plan. Can you talk about that incident with the pedal breaking? Mm.
Yeah, so I did the race in 2008 and it was really just, I wanted to participate in it. I had no, you know, I wasn't under any delusions that I was going to race it or be competitive, but ultimately I had a great experience and I ended up doing better than I thought that I could. And it left me wanting more. And I thought, what would happen if I really applied myself over the next year and returned to this race, not just to, you know, be a middle of the pack or participate, but to actually race it, to like really push it. So that was my kind of driving North Star for that year. And I trained incredibly hard for the race and showed up like guns blazing, ready to go from the gun going off at the outset, and ended up getting out of the first stage, the 10-kilometer swim, with a 10-minute lead on the pack, and held that lead through the 90-mile bike that day, and, you know, won that stage by 10 minutes, which is insane and probably the, you know, the crowning achievement of my athletic life. Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm like leading this race. It was insane. I was 43 years old and, you know, I couldn't believe it. But the following day, you know, didn't go to plan, and about 30, 35 miles into what was to be a 171-mile bike race, I wiped out on wet pavement, went down really hard, broke my pedal, really banged up my knee and my shoulder. My knee were bleeding, my knee was swelling up, and it was on a part of the island called the Red Road, where they wouldn't let crew vehicles follow. Like, it was the only part in this whole race where the competitors were on their own, because just preservation reasons, they didn't want a lot of traffic through this area. So I had to pick myself up and get myself a mile down the road on one pedal, because there was no one to help me. And in doing that, I remember very vividly thinking, you know, I could barely bend my knee. Like, I didn't have any broken bones or anything like that. I was banged up, but I didn't have a pedal. And I was like, I'm done. Like, this race is over with. And as an athlete, the minute you kind of remove your foot from the accelerator, you know, in just the slightest amount, like, you're already checking out from what's actually happening. Like, you've already lost your edge. And I just remember talking myself into the idea of opting out of completing this race and being okay with it. Like, oh my God, like, I broke my pedal. That means, like, no one can blame me for, like, DNFing. And Now I can go to the hotel and I can go to the beach tomorrow with my kids. And, you know, I don't have to, like, do this anymore. And so by the time I got to the end of this road and there are all these crew vehicles there, I saw my wife. I was like, I broke my pedal. I'm done with this race. And I thought it was over with. And that's when a dude who was crewing for another athlete looked at me and said, you know, what kind of pedal do you need? And I was like, well, you know, this is not a conversation I want to be having right now. But he disappeared and he came back with a brand new pedal, the exact model of my pedal. Like, it was like a look pedal. Like out of the box, like brand new, like literally brand new version of exactly what I needed to fit my cleat. And he put it on my bike and made sure there were no cracks in my frame or anything like that. And he's like, get back on your bike and finish. That was not what I wanted to hear. I was like, I'm done. You know, like, this race is over. He's like, no, it's not, you know? And there were all these people there. And I was like, I guess I'm not done. And then, you know, as an athlete, trying to talk yourself back into doing this thing that you've already decided you're not doing is harder than the physical challenge of the thing itself. So, you know, I ended up, you know, obviously, like, I was down and out for, like, I don't know, probably 30 minutes. So the whole, like, being in the lead in the podium, that was all way out the window. I was way in the back now. And it was just about trying to finish. And I just remember suffering terribly to finish that bike ride that day and just feeling horrible the whole time. But getting through it and then facing the prospect of having to run a double marathon on the third day on a swollen knee just seemed like a bad idea and an impossibility. But to make a very long story short, you know, I showed up for that run and began very gingerly at the very back of the pack. And that walk turned into a jog, and the jog, you know, I was able to get my knee loosened up enough to be able to run a little bit. And I just worked my way up through the field from the back of the pack to ultimately end up sixth in that race overall. So it was an incredible experience. And, you know, just so rich for so many reasons and taught me so many things.
Time and time again, I'm reminded that our appreciation soars when we are confronted with this challenge that we are placed into the brink of, am I going to quit or am I going to keep going? And when we find a way to keep going, those are the moments that we remember so much more than if we just succeeded through that experience in a smooth sailing fashion. I'm also fascinated that, you know, when you would have started that race, you would have had this absolute resolute mindset of completion. And just how quickly that mindset can be fractured when we hit a hiccup. Why do you think that's the case?
It's so delicate. I think it has to do with control. Like, when you're an athlete and you're trying to control these variables and then something goes sideways on you, it's a lack of resilience. You're like, well, if it's not going to work out the way that I want it to work out, then fuck it. I'm not doing it at all, you know? And that is fragility. That's not true resilience, you know? So I think the lesson is learning how to roll with the setbacks and the things that don't go your way. Because it's not about what goes your way or doesn't go your way. It's how you respond to those things that really reveals who you are as a human being. And, you know, in the instance of this particular race for me, you know, people say to me, like, well, if you hadn't crashed, or how do you think you would have done, or could you have done this, or could you have done that? And it's like, doesn't matter. Like, I have to remember, like, I didn't get into this whole thing to stand on podiums. I got into it because I was in pain and I was trying to figure out some very difficult questions about who I was. And I needed some life lessons for myself. And that's exactly what this race delivered to me. Like, if everything goes your way, what do you learn? You know, you get a nice ego swell, but the lessons come in how you meet the obstacles. And when I was faced with those setbacks, that's really what, you know, kind of helped me forge character and deepen my relationship with not just myself, but my capacity and my capabilities. And that's what's so beautiful about it. Like, I wouldn't change anything about how it went down because it taught me so much about myself and what I'm what is possible.
This is the reprogramming that I believe not just athletes require, but also the stuff that should be taught in the school system for our kids, that we need to be wired to, you know, craft a goal. And of course, like, visualizing what that process to that end state is going to look like is very important to get you to the start line of whatever that start line is. But if 2020 hasn't taught us anything, it most certainly should have taught us that we shouldn't be so wired to the end state that we forget that in the moment, that's actually where the growth is happening every single step along the way. And reality is, the majority of the time, it's not going to go according to the beautiful plan that we blueprint in the months before it when we don't have the set of circumstances faced in front of us. You know, you're a, you know, probably slightly A-type personality that plans, you're pragmatic. But if you were so fixed on the certain visualization that you casted earlier on, you would never have done half the things that you've done in the last decade, from crafting a podcast to writing multiple books to hosting retreats to connecting with people and sharing stories all the way across the globe. And so I do want to look at this kind of podcasting journey to finish this conversation, because it's really the mechanism that the majority of people who know you know you. Mm-hmm. And there's this beautiful balance of where you are showcasing and creating space for other people's stories, but people have discovered you through that process. I would just love to hear what you have learned through being a podcast host.
Oh, I mean, so many things. I mean, I don't think there's any aspect of my life that has not been positively impacted by this journey, you know. And when you say, like, oh, you know, I suspect you're this kind of type A pragmatic person that plans things out, I would say yes, but part of my evolution has been letting go of a lot of that and feeling into the moment and living a little bit more intuitively and organically. So much so that now when people say, you know, what's the vision, or like, what's your 5-year plan, or what do you think you're going to be doing? I was like, I don't know. You know, like, I'm just like, I don't know. I'm going to go like podcast with this dude today. And like, that's cool. You know, like, that's kind of, I'm way more rooted in like the moment. And everything that has happened with the podcast is really just a simple reflection of that. I didn't intend for it to be anything. I did one episode with Julie because I thought it would be fun. And I was like, that's cool. Let's do it again. This is fun. You know, who else can I talk to? And then the next day, who else can I talk to? And it's really just been about that. It's been about process. It's been about my own, like, following my own curiosity and being able to show up and be present with other human beings with a level of humility and quietude and presence to be able to learn from them. And then in turn, you know, being a channel for other people to have that experience digitally. But it's not by dint of some goal that I set for myself or some, you know, kind of, you know, idea about what I thought it could be. Like, the fact that, like, it was never intended to be anything professional at all. Like, I did it for years before we monetized it at all. Like, it never occurred to me that this would be something that we would monetize. Like, it was just a passion project. And now it provides for my family in a way that I couldn't have, it's comical actually, you know, what's happened. But I think what, you know, why it's worked is really because I put myself, I'm following my own muse and my own curiosity, but I'm also trying to put myself in the seat of the audience so that the audience member is experiencing this person the way that I'm experiencing them for the first time. And I try to think of the questions that I would like answered, but also what I think, you know, the audience would most want to hear from this person. And I try to do it with humility and authenticity and honesty, to bring some aspect of my experience to it, but also to really get out of the way, you know, to really get out of the way,
yeah,
and try to let this person shine as best as they can. And it's, you know, it's something that, you know, could have easily been a triathlon podcast or just a vegan podcast, but, you know, I really just, I cast my net, you know, where I'm curious in the moment. Like, what do I want to learn about? Like, I didn't change my diet and go become this endurance athlete to stay there. These are tools for growth. That growth continues. It's everlasting. You're always, should always be committed to iterating and growing. So what's next? What are the other, you know, if I was so blind about how I was living in certain ways, I'm still blind to so many things now. How can I pull those blinders off? What are the other areas of my life that need redress right now? Well, let's go there. Let's go there. Let's see what that's about. And I think the audience feels that on some level. And there's a little something for everyone. And like you said at the beginning, I don't even know if we were recording at that point, like, I love bringing people. It's fun to interview like famous people or people you've heard of, but what's really great is like finding somebody no one's ever heard of and then who's amazing and then sharing that person with them. Like, it's so delicious. Like, and to have the trust of the audience to say, like, I don't know who this person is, but like, I trust Rich and I enjoy his show, so I'm going to listen or watch anyway, has been really cool.
I mean, a podcast that did that for me was the John McAvoy conversation.
How amazing is that guy?
And amazing conversation. And, you know, I don't typically reach out to someone after I listen to their podcast, but after hearing the two of you talk, I reached out to him afterwards and, you know, we shared a nice dialogue and I just, what he went through and how he's chosen to move through it, but also not just for himself, but for other youth at risk or other people who might have gone through the path that he's gone through. It's incredibly compelling. Mm. And it was just a very real conversation. And I would never have been exposed to someone like him if I hadn't have listened to your podcast. And I think that's what you've done. You've taken people from different walks of life that don't seem to fit just the one mold. And I feel that's a really good thing on a podcast, because then you'll just have the one type of person who listens to it as well. So right, you're broadening out your network of people who get exposed to it because you're dipping into different types of people through the conversations.
I think everything that I've learned about how to be an effective podcaster, I've learned in the rooms of 12 Step, because you get a master's degree in how to listen and how to be empathetic. You learn how to share your story, but you also stand witness to all forms of humanity who get up and summon the courage to be honest and vulnerable with their pain. And it impacts you profoundly. And you do develop a level of empathy for the human experience that I think is unusual and I think is distinct in kind of what I do. Like, I think, you know, that's kind of the touchstone of what I do, to be able to listen, to be present, to be empathetic, and to reserve judgment. I think are all things that we need more of in our culture, that we're, you know, we have a dearth of at the moment. And so that's why I try to inject these experiences with that, because that feels like right and unique to what I can do that's maybe a little bit different in the space.
Well, if, you know, the podcast is often based on where your curiosity lies at that point in time, you know, with 2020 looking the way that it has, what have been, you know, the tenets of your curiosity this year, and what have you tried to showcase on the podcast?
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about this before we were recording. I mean, this year, you know, in all its unprecedented, you know, challenges and glory, is certainly unique, and it left me, you know, I sort of was doing things the way that I was always doing them, and most of my conversations are relatively evergreen, meaning it doesn't really matter when they go up, like the news cycle doesn't impact the timeliness or lack thereof of the particular conversation. But that started to shift when the world started to spin off its axis a little bit and things started to get crazy. It felt bizarre to put up a conversation with a doctor about a health issue when we're in the midst of social upheaval and, you know, such political acrimony and all these other problems that we're contending with. And I felt drawn to elevate my presence in contemporaneous conversations about things that were pertinent and actually mattered in the moment, which is new. You know, it's like I'm having podcasts with John McAvoy and with Samantha Gash and with doctors about the microbiome. And now I was like, I need to, you know, we need to talk about race in America. We need to talk about systemic racism. We need to talk about the dismantling of our democratic institutions. We need to talk about a lack of diversity. I need to take responsibility for the lack of diversity on my own show. And how can I redress that? And how can I own that? And how can I, you know, sit down with somebody whose life experience is so different from mine and with humility ask for guidance about how to be an ally, or for that person to point out to me my own blind spots in, you know, what's actually transpiring right now. And that's a risk. You know, it's very easy. It would be very easy for me to just keep doing what I'm doing. It's working, blah, blah, blah. But I just didn't, I didn't want to be on the other side of this and look back and think, I could have participated in what was actually happening in a meaningful way, and I chose not to. And I just couldn't bear, I couldn't bear that thought. You know, the what was looping in my mind was, what's the point in having a huge platform and a large audience if you're not going to, you know, basically leverage it in a moment in which there is a need for these types of conversations? And at the same time, you know, as a father with four kids and two teenage daughters, you know, I want to be on the right side of history, and I want my daughters to look back on how I conducted myself during this specific moment and feel like their dad, you know, stood up for what was right.
What's the feedback been from the shift?
It's been mixed. You know, I'm sure that I've lost a slice of the audience. There's a lot of people who are like, this is amazing, and I have so much respect for what you're saying. But, you know, the level of like hate and acrimony is, you know, is noticeable. Yeah. I can tell you that. And whether that's a small vocal minority or not, who knows? So for me, the challenge has been like, can you stand in your conviction and, you know, mute that out or not pay attention to that? Like how, you know, rather than be swayed by, you know, whatever, you know, comments are swirling around on the internet. So, you know, not that I didn't really get that much negative feedback prior. And now I've put myself in a place of being more exposed to that. And that's a bargain that I welcome, and it's fine. But that doesn't mean that it's always comfortable.
Well, yeah. No one, even if you're not a people pleaser, it's always a surprise and a bit of a shock to the senses to see the way some people can vocalize, particularly in the written form via social media, their dissatisfaction of the direction you've taken.
Yeah. Very quick to let you know.
Oh, so quick. And you know what? You've got to keep going in where your curiosity and your truth is. And I think there's a lot of people who are experiencing this right now and trying to find what their place is in this. And to do nothing, if that's not what you want to do, but because you feel compelled by other people to act in that way, you know, down the track, you might have different feelings towards that action. So I think to try with openness is a really great place. So let's just cap this off, because this has been an amazing conversation. I know you've given me so much of your time. I wanted to finish it by asking you two things. Can you please share with us one thing that you're great at and one thing that you're grateful for?
I think I'm great at empathy to a fault. Like, I'm somebody who sees the gray in everything, and I veer towards nuance. You know, in a black and white world, like, I'm always able to, like, see the validity in somebody else's argument or life experience. And I think it serves me well as a podcast host, but it you know, it causes complications in my life as well. So empathy is huge. The other one was, what was the second part of the question?
What are you grateful for?
Oh, grateful for. I'm grateful for my sobriety, because without it, I wouldn't even be here. So it always goes back to that as the number one thing.
Is that what you think on a daily basis when you consider yourself as still in recovery?
On a daily basis, I'm a resentful, angry, selfish human being who's grouchy. That's my daily. So, like, the gratitude is it's a practice. Like, I practice it like you practice, you know, like you practice archery or track and field. You know, it's like I have to show up for it and apply myself to connect with that.
I'm so delighted to have you on the podcast, Rich. Like, it would have been amazing to do this in person as we had planned, but, you know, the current situation means that this is the next best plan, and I think it's still pretty great. And I'm sure at some point down the track we'll get to be sharing a cup of tea, maybe in Malibu, and maybe going for a run in your beautiful backyard mountains together.
Or maybe I'm headed to Australia again. Who knows? I might have to get out of here.
Actually, I did get a now that you've said that, I did get a question from someone who knows you very well, who said, when is the impending move to Byron?
Oh, man. Who is it that knows me? Well, you could tell me later.
I'll tell you later.
I do have, like, a fantasy of, like, having a place in Byron. Like, I just love it. So much fun there. Like, I love it there. It's perfect. I don't know the reality around that. Like, I have young daughter. Like, I'm not, like, moving. You know, I got young daughters who are, their lives are here. But I think at some point I could see myself splitting time between Byron and the States. We'll see. To be continued.
We'll keep in touch with that one. Yeah. We'll welcome you with open arms.
And if it makes you feel better, it's now, like, probably 100 degrees in this container. So I'm having the experience that you were having when you sat here a couple of years ago.
Well, I'm happy to give you the slippery leg effect, where I remember my legs were crossed at one point and the amount of sweat that they produced, they just slipped apart.
It's hilarious.
Oh, thank you, Rich. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I have so much respect and admiration for you as a human being and how you conduct yourself in the world, and you're entering into this new chapter as a mother and a parent and a partner and all these things. And I applaud you doing this podcast, and I adore you, and it's been an honor to talk to you. So thank you, Samantha.
Oh, thank you.
I want to thank you for joining myself and Rich on this two-part episode. You know, I want to cap it off by saying something that Rich once wrote, and he wrote, "I didn't reach my athletic peak until I was 43. I didn't write my first book until I was 44. I didn't start my podcast until I was 45. At 30, I thought my life was over. At 52, I know it's just beginning. Keep running, never give up, and watch your kite soar." I mean, this is a perfect moment in time to reflect on that idea that our story is ever continuing. We are ever evolving. I hope there were nuggets in there that are helping you right now, or you can carry through to later on. If you found this conversation to be helpful, I'd love it if you could share it via social media or just word of mouth, whatever makes best sense for you. Or, of course, subscribe, rate, and review. If you would like to look at Rich's book, Voicing Change, you can find it on his website, richroll.com, as well as plenty of other information. Again, thank you for your time to be in this space, and I hope that you are happy, safe, and well wherever you are.